I watched her struggling to restrain her impatience whenever poor Carapiciano had no choice but to draw her away from Lamin and back towards all the necessary mundane tasks of the day. Signing papers, meeting ministers, discussing school fees, sustainability, curriculum, teachers' pay. Half a dozen times he made Amy and the rest of us stop where we were, so that we might listen to yet another government functionary give yet another speech about partnership and mutual respect, and in particular the respect the President for Life wanted passed on to Amy in his absence, which itself was only the correct response owed for the respect Amy clearly does possess for our beloved President, as we all stood suffering in the sun. Each speech was near identical to the one before it, as if there were some urtext back in the city from which all these ministers had been instructed to quote. As we approached the school, slowly, so as not to outpace the photographer who scuttled backwards before us, one of these ministers once more pressed Carapiciano's hand, and when Carapiciano tried, quietly and out of Amy's sightline, to dissuade him, the minister refused to be dissuaded, standing his ground at the school gate, blocking the entrance and beginning his speech, upon which Amy abruptly turned her back. "Look, Fern, I don't mean to be an asshole about it, but I'm really trying to be present in this moment. And you're making that very hard for me right now. It's hot, we're all hot, and I'm really mindful that we haven't got a lot of time this time around. So I think we can put a hold on the speeches. I think we all know where we stand. We all feel welcomed. We all feel mutually respected or whatever. Right now, I'm here to be present. No more speeches today, okay?" Carapiciano looked down, half defeated, at his clipboard, and for a moment I thought he was about to lose his temper. Beside him, the minister stood unperturbed, not having followed what Amy had said, simply waiting for his cue to begin again. "It is time to visit the school," said Carapiciano, without looking up, reaching round the minister and pushing open the gate. The nanny, Estelle, was there to meet us with the children, and they ran through the mammoth sandy schoolyard, empty except for two bent and netless goalmouths, high-fiving any child who came near, delighted to be let loose among so many of their kind. Jay was 8 at the time, and Cara 6. They'd been home-tutored all their lives. As we passed through our whistle-stop tour of 6 large, hot, cheerily painted classrooms, their many childish questions came tumbling out. Questions not unlike my own, but in their case unedited and unconsidered, and which their nanny kept trying, unsuccessfully, to hush and silence. I wish I could add to them. "Why does the headmaster have 2 wives? Why do some girls wear scarves and some not? Why are all the books torn and dirty? Why are they being taught in English if they don't speak English at home? Why do the teachers spell the words wrong on the board? If the new school is for girls, what will happen to the boys?" 9. Most Saturdays, as my own middle passage approached, I accompanied my mother to a protest march of one kind or another, against South Africa, against the government, against nuclear bombs, against racism, against cuts, against the deregulation of the banks or in support of the teachers' union, the GLC or the IRA. The purpose of all this was hard for me to grasp, given the nature of our enemy. I saw her on television most days. Rigid handbag, rigid hair, unturned, unturnable, and always unmoved by however many people my mother and her cronies had managed to gather to march the previous Saturday morning through Trafalgar Square and right up to her shiny black front door. I remember marching for the preservation of the Greater London Council a year earlier, walking for what felt like days, half a mile behind my mother, who was up at the front deep in conversation with Red Ken, carrying a placard above my head, and then, after that got too heavy, carrying it over my shoulder like Jesus at the crucifixion, lugging it down Whitehall, until finally we got the bus home, collapsed in the lounge, switched on the TV, and learnt that the GLC had been abolished earlier that same day. Still, I was told there was no time for dancing, or in a variation that this was not the time for dancing, as if the historical moment itself forbade it. I had responsibilities. They were tied to my intelligence, which had been recently confirmed by a young supply teacher up at the school who had thought to ask our class to bring in whatever we were reading at home. It was one of those moments, there were many, when we, the students, were reminded of the fundamental innocence of our teachers. They gave us seeds in the spring to plant in our gardens, or asked us after the summer break to write a page about where you went on holiday. It wasn't something that hurt me. I'd been to Brighton many times, and once on a booze cruise to France, and was a keen window box gardener. But what about the gypsy girl who smelt, who had weeping sores around her mouth and a weakly black eye? Or the twins, too old and dark for adoption, who bounced around the local foster homes? What about the boy with the eczema, whom Tracy and I spotted through the bars of Queen's Park one summer night, alone, fast asleep on a bench? Supply teachers were the most innocent of them all. I remember the surprise of this one at the not small number of children who brought in either the radio or TV Times. I brought in my biographies of dancers, thick books with soft-focus 70s portraits on the cover, of the great stars in their old age, in their silk dressing gowns and cravats, in their pink ostrich feather capes, and on page count alone, it was decided that my future should be discussed. My mother came in for a meeting, early, before school, where she was told that the same books she sometimes teased me for reading were evidence of my intelligence, and that there was a test such gifted children could take, which, if they passed, would enable them to attend the kind of good schools that give scholarships. No, 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 no fees, don't worry. I meant grammars, which are a different thing altogether. No money involved at all. No, no, please don't worry. I glanced at my mother, whose face gave nothing away. It's because of the reading age, explained the teacher, passing over our silence. You see, her reading age is really quite advanced. The teacher looked my mother over, her braless vest and jeans, the Kente cloth head wrap, a pair of huge earrings shaped like Africa, and asked if the father would be joining us. The father's at work, said my mother. Oh, said the teacher, turning to me. And what does your father do, dear? Is he the reader of the house, or... The father's a postman, said my mother. The mother's the reader. Now, normally, said the teacher, blushing, consulting her notes, normally we don't suggest the entrance exam for the independent schools, really. I mean, there are some scholarships available, but there's no point setting these kids up for disappointment. But this young Miss Bradwell we've had in recently thought perhaps, well, she thought that, in your daughter's situation, it might just be the case that... We walked home in silence. There was nothing more to discuss. We had already been to visit the huge and raucous comp I'd be attending in the autumn. It had been sold to me on the promise it had a dance studio, somewhere in that warren of scuffed corridors, porter cabin classrooms, and temporary toilets. Everyone that I knew, excepting Tracy, was heading there, and this was one comfort: safety in numbers. But my mother surprised me. In the grounds of the estate, she stopped at the base of the stairwell and told me that I'd take that test and work hard to pass it. No dancing at the weekend, no distractions of any kind. I was being given the kind of opportunity, she said, that she had never had herself, having been advised, at the same age I was now, and by her own teachers, to work on mastering 40 words a minute like all the other black girls. It felt to me as if I were on a certain train, heading wherever it was people like me usually went in adolescence. Except now, suddenly, something was different. I'd been informed that I would be getting off at an unexpected stop, further down the line. I thought of my father, pushed off the train before he'd barely left the station, and of Tracy, so determined to jump off, exactly because she'd rather walk than be told which stop was hers or how far she was allowed to go. Well, wasn't there something noble in that? Wasn't there some fight in it, at least, some defiance? And then there were all the outrageous historical cases I heard of at my mother's knee, tales of the furiously talented women, and these were all women in my mother's telling, women who might have run faster than a speeding train if they had been free to do so, but for whom, born in the wrong time, in the wrong place, all stops were closed, who were never even permitted to enter the station. And wasn't I so much freer than any of them, born in England in modern times, not to mention so much lighter, so much straighter of nose, so much less likely to be mistaken for the very essence of blackness itself? What could possibly stop me travelling on? Yet when I sat down in my own school hall on a stifling July day outside of normal school hours, an unnatural time to be at school, and opened those test papers to read through the opportunity my mother wished I would grab with both hands. A great, sullen fury came over me. I didn't feel like travelling on their train. Wrote a few words here and there, ignored the pages of maths and science. Flagrantly failed. 10. A few weeks later, Tracy got into her stage school. Her mother had no choice but to ring my mother's doorbell, enter our flat, and tell us all about it. She stuck Tracy in front of her like a shield, shuffled into the hall, wouldn't sit down or have tea. She'd never been over the threshold before.
The judges said they'd not seen anything like her original...
Tracy's mother stopped dead and looked angrily at her daughter, who then provided the unfamiliar word.
Original choreography. Not like that. That's how new it was. Never. I always told her that she'd have to be twice as good as the next girl to get anywhere,
she said, hugging her Tracy into her mammoth bosom.
And now she is.
She had a video of the audition to give us, which my mother took graciously enough. I found it under a pile of books in her bedroom and watched it alone one night. The song was Swing is Here to Stay, and every movement, every blink, every nod was Jenny Lagonne's. That autumn, in my first term at my new school, I found out what I was without my friend. A body without a distinct outline. The kind of girl who moved from group to group, neither welcomed nor despised, tolerated and always eager to avoid confrontation. I felt I made no impression. There were, for a while, a couple of girls in the year above who believed I prided myself on my high colour, on my long nose, on my freckles, and they bullied me. Stole money from me, harassed me on the bus. But bullies need resistance of some kind, even if it's only tears, and I gave them none, and they soon got bored and left me alone. Most of my years in that school I don't remember. Even as I was living them, a stubborn part of me never accepted it as anything more than a place I had to survive each day until I was free again. I was more engaged with what I imagined of Tracy's schooling than with the reality of my own. I remember her telling me, for example, not long after she arrived in the place, that when Fred Astaire died, her school held a memorial assembly, and some of the students were asked to dance in tribute. Tracy, dressed as Bojangles, in a white top hat and tails, brought the house down. I know I never saw her do this, but even now I feel I have a memory of it. 13, 14, 15, the difficult middle passage. In those years, I really didn't see much of her. Her new life swallowed her up. She was not there when my father finally moved out, or when I got my period. I don't know when she lost her virginity, or if and by whom she first got her heart broken. Whenever I saw her in the streets, it seemed to me that she was doing well. She would be wrapped around a very handsome, mature-looking young man, often tall and with a sharp fade cut into his hair. And I think of her on these occasions as not so much walking as bouncing by, fresh-faced, hair pulled up tight in a dancer's bun, wearing neon leggings and a crop top, but also red-eyed, clearly stoned, electric, charismatic, outrageously sexual, filled with the summer's energy at all times, even in freezing February. And to come across her like this, as she really was, that is, outside of my own envious ideas about her, was always a form of existential shock, like seeing someone from a storybook in real life, and I would do everything I could to make the encounter as brief as possible, sometimes crossing the street before she reached me, or jumping on a bus, or claiming to be heading for somewhere urgently. Even when I heard, a little later on, from my mother and others in the neighbourhood, that she was having difficulties, more and more frequently in trouble, I couldn't imagine why that would be. Her life was perfect, as far as I was concerned. And this is one side effect of envy, maybe, this failure of imagination. In my mind, her struggles were over. She was a dancer. She'd found her tribe. I, meanwhile, was caught completely unawares by adolescence, still humming Gershwin songs at the back of the classroom, as the friendship rings began to form and harden around me, defined by colour, class, money, postcode, nation, music, drugs, politics, sports, aspirations, languages, sexualities. In that huge game of musical chairs, I turned round one day and found I had no place to sit. At a loss, I became a goth, It was where people who had nowhere else to go ended up. Goths were already a minority, and I joined the oddest chapter, a small group of only 5 kids. One was from Romania and had a clubfoot. Another was Japanese. Black Goths were rare but not unprecedented. I'd seen a few of them hanging around Camden, and now copied them as best I could, dusting my face ghost white and painting my lips blood red, letting my hair half dread and spraying some parts of it purple. I bought a pair of Dr. Martens and covered them in Tippex'd anarchy symbols. I was 14. The world was pain. I was in love with my Japanese friend. He was in love with a fragile blonde in our circle who had scars all up her arms and looked like a broken cat left out in the rain. She couldn't love anybody. For almost 2 years we spent all our time together. I hated the music, and there was no dancing allowed, just pogoing up and down, or else swaying drunkenly into each other. But I liked that the political apathy disgusted my mother, and that the brutality of my new look brought out the keenly maternal side of my father, who now worried about me endlessly and tried to feed me up as I gothically lost weight. I bunked off for the greater part of each week. The bus that went to school also went to Camden Lock. We sat on the towpaths, drinking cider and smoking, DMs hanging over the canal, discussing the phoniness of everyone we knew, free-form conversations that could eat up whole days. Violently, I denounced my mother, the old neighborhood, everything from my childhood, above all, Tracy. My new friends were made to listen to every detail of our mutual history, all of it retold in a bitter spirit, stretching back to the very first day we met, walking across a churchyard. After an afternoon of that, I'd get back on the bus, pass by the grammar school I'd failed to get into, and get off at a stop outside, but precisely outside, my father's new bachelor flat, where I could happily go back in time, eat his comfort food, indulge in the old secret pleasures. Judy Garland pretending to be a Zulu, dancing the cakewalk in Meet Me in St. Louis. 11. Our second visit came 4 months later, in the rainy season. We arrived in darkness after a delayed flight, and when we reached the pink house, I couldn't get over the oddness of that place, the sadness and emptiness of it, the feeling I had of moving into somebody else's broken ambition. Rain pelted the cab roof. I asked Fernando if he wouldn't mind if I went back to Howard's compound. For me, it's very fine. I have a lot of work to do. You'll be all right. I mean, by yourself. He laughed. I have been alone in much worse places. We parted at the huge, peeling billboards that marked the beginning of the village. I got soaked walking 20 yards, pushed open the aluminium door of Howard's family compound, weighted by an oil can half-filled with sand but unlocked as always. Inside was almost unrecognizable to me. In the yard, where there had been 4 months earlier, neatly raked red earth, and grandmothers, cousins, nephews, nieces, sisters, and many babies sitting all around late into the night, now there was nobody, only a churned mud pit into which I immediately sank and lost a shoe. When I reached down for it, I heard laughter. I looked up and realized I was being watched from the concrete veranda. Howard and a few of her girlfriends, carrying the tin plates from dinner back to wherever they were kept. "Uh-oh," cried Howard, laughing at the sight of me, bedraggled, and now carrying in my arms a large suitcase that refused to roll through the sludge. "Look what the rain brings." I had not expected to stay with Howard again, hadn't warned her, but neither she nor anybody else in the compound seemed very surprised by my arrival. And though I hadn't been a particularly successful or well-loved houseguest the first time round, I was welcomed like family. I shook hands with the various grandmothers, and we hugged, Howard and I, and said how much we'd missed each other. I explained that on this trip there was only Fernando and me, Amy was recording in New York, and that we were here to observe in further detail what was being done in the old school and what might be improved in the new one. I was invited to join Howard and her visitors in the small living room, dimly lit with white solar, more keenly illuminated by the screens of each girl's phone. We smiled at each other, the girls, Howard, me. My mother's and father's health were politely asked after. It was again considered astonishing that I had no siblings. And then Amy's and her children's health were asked after, and Carapaciano's and Judy's, but none more solicitously than Granger's. Granger's health was what they were really interested in, for Granger had been the real hit of the first visit, far more than Amy or any of the rest of us. We were curiosities. He was loved. Granger knew all the cheesy R&B tracks that Howard adored, Amy disdained, and I'd never heard of. He wore all the kinds of sneakers she most admired, and during a celebratory drum circle put on by the mothers at the school, without hesitation had entered the ring, brushed his shoulders, body-popped, vogued, and performed the moonwalk, while I cringed in my seat and busied myself taking pictures. "That Granger," said Howa now, shaking her head happily at the thrilling memory of Granger compared to the dull reality of me. "Such a crazy dancer. All the boys were saying, 'Are these the new moves?' And remember, your Amy said to us, 'No, these are the old ones.' You remember? But he's not with you this time. It's a shame. Oh, Granger is such a fun guy." The young women in the room laughed and shook their heads and sighed, and then a silence fell again, and it began to dawn on me that I had interrupted a get-together, a gossipy good time, which now, after a minute of awkward silence, resumed in Wolof. Not wanting to go to the complete darkness of the bedroom, I sat back in the sofa, let the talk wash over me and my clothes air dry on my body. Next to me, Howard held court, 2 hours' worth of stories which, from what I could tell, ranged from the hilarious to the mournful to the righteously offended, but never stretched as far as anger. Laughter and sighs were my guide, and the photos from her phone, which she flashed in the middle of certain anecdotes and cursorily explained in English if I made a point of asking. I gathered she had a love problem. A young policeman in Banjul whom she rarely saw, and a big plan, already anticipated, to go to the beach when the rains ended, for a family gathering to which the policeman would be invited. She showed me the picture from this event the previous year. A panoramic shot that took in at least 100 people. I spotted her in the front row and noticed the absence of scarf. Instead, she had a silky weave on her head, parted in the center and falling to her shoulders. "Different hair," I said, and Howa laughed, put her hands to her hijab and removed it, revealing 4 inches of her own hair twisted into little dreads.
"But it grows so slow, oh?"
It took me a while to figure out that Howa was that relative rarity in the village, a middle-class girl, the daughter of 2 university teachers, neither of whom I ever met. Her father was working in Milan now as a traffic warden, and her mother lived in the city and still worked at the university. Her father had taken what people in the village called the back way, along with Howa's elder brother, travelling through the Sahara to Libya, and then finally making the dangerous crossing to Lampedusa. 2 years later, by then married to an Italian, he sent for the other brother, but that was 6 years ago, and if Howa was still waiting for her call, she was far too proud to tell me. The money the father sent home had brought certain luxuries to the compound, rare in the village. A tractor, a large lot of private land, a toilet, though it was not connected to anything, and a television, though it did not work. The compound itself housed the 4 wives of Howard's dead grandfather and many of the children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren his unions had produced in ever-changing combinations. It was never possible to locate all the parents to these children. Only the grandmothers remained constant, passing babies and toddlers back and forth between themselves and to Howa, who, despite her youth, often seemed to me to be the head of the household, or at least the heart of it. She was one of those people who attract everybody. Emphatically cute, with a perfectly circular blue-black face, Disney-bright features, very pretty long eyelashes, and something adorably duck-like in her full and forward upper lip. Anybody seeking lightness, silliness, or simply to be playfully teased for an hour or two knew to come to Howa, and she took an equal interest in everybody, wanted to hear all news, no matter how apparently quotidian or banal. "You were just in the market? Oh, so tell me, who was there, and was the fishman there?" She would have been the jewel in the crown of any small village anywhere. She had, unlike me, no contempt whatsoever for village life. She loved the smallness, the gossip, the repetition, and the closeness of family. She liked that everybody's business was her business, and vice versa. A neighbour of Howard's with a more difficult love problem than her own came by to visit us daily. She'd fallen for a boy her parents wouldn't let her marry, and held Howard's hands as she spoke and wept, often not leaving till 1 in the morning. And yet, I noticed, she always left smiling. I tried to think of ever performing a similar service for a friend. I wanted to know more about this love problem, but translation bored Howard, and in her impatient version, 2 hours of talk was easily boiled down to a couple of sentences. "Well, she is saying he is very beautiful and kind, and they will never marry. I'm so sad. I tell you, I won't sleep tonight. But come on, haven't you learnt even a little bit of Wolof yet?" Sometimes, when Howard's guests arrived and found me sitting in my dark corner, they would look wary and turn back. But just as Howard was known everywhere as the bearer of lightness, someone whose very presence brought relief from woe, it was very soon clear to everyone that the visitor from England had brought with her only weight and sorrow. All the morbid questions I felt I must ask with a pen in my hand concerning poverty reduction, or the lack of supplies at the school, or the apparent hardships of Howard's own life, to which were now added the difficulties of the rainy season, the mosquitoes, the threat of untreated malaria. All of this repelled our guests and severely tested Howard's patience. Political talk didn't interest her, unless it was conspiratorial, intensely local, and directly concerned people she knew. And she also disliked any too strenuous conversation on the topics of religion or culture. Like everybody, she prayed and went to the mosque, but as far as I could see, she had no serious religious interest. She was the kind of girl who wants only one thing from this life: to have fun. I remembered the type very well from my own school days. Girls like that have always mystified me. They still do. And I felt I mystified Howard equally. I lay on the floor next to her each night, on our neighbouring mattresses, grateful for the blue aura that came off her Samsung as she scrolled through her messages and photographs, sometimes well into the wee hours, laughing or sighing at pictures that amused her, breaking up the dark and relieving the need for conversation. But nothing ever seemed to outrage or seriously depress her, and perhaps because I saw so many things that elicited exactly these emotions in me every day, I found myself consumed by a perverse desire to rouse the same feelings in her. One night as we lay side by side, as she again reflected on how much fun Granger had been, how cool and fun, I asked her what she made of the president's promise to personally decapitate any homosexual he found in the country. She sucked her teeth and continued scrolling. "That man is always talking up some nonsense. Anyway, we have none of those people here." She did not connect my question with Granger, but I went to sleep that night burning with shame that I would be so willing to casually destroy the possibility of Granger ever returning here, and for the sake of, what, principle? I knew how much Granger had loved it here, even more than Paris, and much more than London, and that he felt this way despite the existential threat the visit had surely represented for him. We'd spoken about it often. It broke up the boredom of recording sessions, sitting in the booth together, smiling at Amy through the glass, never listening to her sing. And these were the most substantial conversations I'd ever had with Granger, as if the village had unlocked in us in a relation we did not know we had. Not that we agreed or made the same connections. Where I saw deprivation, injustice, poverty, Granger saw simplicity, a lack of materialism, communal beauty, the opposite of the America in which he'd been raised. Where I saw polygamy, misogyny, motherless children, my mother's island childhood, only writ large, enshrined in custom, he remembered a sixth-floor walk-up, a tiny studio apartment shared with a depressed single mother, the loneliness, the food stamps, the lack of meaning, the threat of the streets right outside his front door, and spoke to me with genuine tears in his eyes of how happier he might have been raised by not one woman but 15. Once, when it happened to be just Howard and me in the yard, and she was plaiting my hair, I tried again to speak of difficult things, exploiting the intimacy of the moment to ask her about a rumour I'd heard, about a vanished village woman, apparently seized by the police, the mother of a young man who'd participated in a recent attempted coup. No one knew where she was, or what had happened to her. "There was a girl who came here last year. Her name was Lindsay," said Howard, as if I had not spoken at all. "It was before Amy and you all came. She was from the Peace Corps. She was American, and she was really fun.
We played 21 and we played blackjack. You play cards? I tell you, she was really fun, man.
She sighed, laughed, and pulled my hair tight. I gave up. Howard's own preferred topic was the R&B star Chris Brown, but I had almost nothing to say about Chris Brown, and only one song of his on my phone. That is a very, very, very old song, she informed me. Whereas she knew everything there was to know about the man, including all his moves. One morning, just before she left for school, I spotted her in the yard, dancing with her earphones in. She was dressed in her technically modest yet intensely form-hugging trainee schoolteacher outfit. A white blouse, long black lycra skirt, yellow hijab, yellow sandals, yellow watch, and a snug pinstripe waistcoat, which she made sure was pulled especially tight at the back to make a feature of a tiny waist and spectacular bosom. She looked up from where she was admiring the quick steps of her own feet, saw me, and laughed. "Don't you tell my students." Each day of that visit, Carapaciano and I went into the school, visiting Howard's and Lamin's classrooms, making notes. Carapaciano focused on every aspect of the school's functioning, while my remit was narrower. I went first to Lamin's class and then Howard's, looking for the best and the brightest, as I had been instructed by Amy to do. In Lamin's class, a maths class, this was easy. I only had to put down the names of the girls who got the right answers. And that's what I did, waiting each time for Lamin to confirm, on the board, that the answers of the children were correct. For anything beyond basic addition and subtraction was, in truth, beyond my ability. And I watched Lamin's 10-year-old multiply more quickly than me and reach long division answers I could not even stumble towards. I would grip my pen and feel my hand sweating. It was like time travel. I was right back in my own maths classes. I had the same old, familiar feelings of shame, and still retained, as it turned out, my childhood habit of self-deception, covering my workings with my hand as Lamin passed by and always managing to half-convince myself, once the answer was up on the board, that I had been very close to getting it all along. But for this or that small error, the terrible heat in the room, my own irrational anxiety in the face of numbers. I was relieved to leave Lamin and head to Howard's session, a general class. There I had decided to look for the Tracys, that is, for the brightest, the quickest, the most willful, the lethally bored, the troublesome, the girls whose eyes burnt like lasers straight through the government-issued English sentences, dead sentences, sentences devoid of content or meaning, that were being laboriously transcribed in chalk up onto the board by Howard before being equally laboriously translated back into Wolof and thus explained. I had expected to find only a few Tracys in each class, but it soon became clear that there were more of Tracy's tribe in those hot rooms than anyone else. Some of these girls' uniforms were so worn they were now little more than rags. Others had open sores on their feet or eyes weeping pus, and when I watched the school fees being paid into the teachers' hands each morning in coins, many did not have their coin to give. And yet they had not given up, these many Tracys. They were not satisfied with singing their lines back to Howard, who herself, only a few years earlier, must have sat in these seats, singing these same lines, clinging to her textbook then as she did now. Watching all that fire with so little kindling, it was of course easy to despair. But each time the conversation was freed from its pointless English shackles and allowed to fall back into the local tongues, I would see it again, the clear sparks of intelligence, like flames licking through a grill meant to smother them, and taking the same form natural intelligence takes in classrooms around the world. Backchat, humour, argument. It was Howard's unfortunate duty to silence all of this, all natural inquiry and curiosity, and drag the class back to the government textbook in hand, to write, "The pot is on the fire," or "The spoon is in the bowl," with a piece of broken chalk on the board, and have them repeat it, and then to have them write this down, copying it exactly, including Howard's own frequent errors. After watching this painful process for a few days, I realized that she never once tested them on these written lines without the answer being already in front of them or having just been repeated. And one especially hot afternoon, I felt I had to resolve the question for myself. I asked Howard to sit where I sat on a broken stool so I could stand up before the class and ask them to write in their books, "The pot is on the fire." They looked up at the empty board and then expectantly at Howard, awaiting the translation. I wouldn't let her speak. 2 long minutes followed, as children stared blankly at their half-ruined exercise books, recovered many times over in old wrapping paper. Then I went around the room, collecting the books to show to Howa. Some part of me enjoyed doing this. 3 girls in 40 had written the sentence correctly in English. The rest had 1 word or 2. Almost all of the boys had no written letters at all. Just vague markings reminiscent of English vowels and consonants, the shadows of letters but not letters themselves. Howa nodded at each book, betraying no emotion, and then, when I had finished, stood up and continued her class. When the bell rang for lunch, I ran across the yard to find Carapaciano, who was sitting under the mango tree, making notes in a pad, and told him in an excitable hurry all the events of the morning and the implications as I saw them, imagining how slow my own progress might have been if my teachers had taught our curriculum in, say, Mandarin, though I spoke Mandarin nowhere else, heard no Mandarin, had parents who spoke no Mandarin. Carapaciano put his pen down and stared at me.
I see. And what is it you think you just achieved?
At first I thought he hadn't understood me, so restated my case from the top, but he cut me off, stamping a foot in the sand.
All you did was humiliate a teacher in front of her class.
His voice was quiet, but his face very red. He took off his glasses and glared at me, and looked so gravely handsome it lent a certain weight to his position, as if those who are right are always more beautiful. I'm not saying it's a question of ability, it's a structural issue. You always say that yourself. And I'm just saying that maybe we could have an English lesson, okay? Of course, but let's teach them in their own languages, in their own country. And then they could take English tests home as homework or something.
Fernando laughed bitterly and swore in Portuguese.
Homework? Have you been to their homes? Do you see books on their shelves? Or shelves? Desks?
He stood up and started shouting.
What do you think these children do when they get home? Study? Do you think they have time to study?
He had not moved towards me, but I found myself backing away from him until I was up against the trunk of the mango tree.
What are you doing here? What experience do you have in this work? This is adult work. You behave like a teenager. But you're not a teenager anymore, are you? Isn't it time you grew up?
I burst into tears. Somewhere a bell rang. I heard Fernando sigh with what sounded like sympathy, and I had a wild hope for a moment that he was about to put his arm around me. With my head in my hands, I heard hundreds of kids burst from their classrooms and run through the yard, laughing and shouting on their way to their next lessons, or out of the gates to help their mothers on the farm. And then Carapaciano, kicking the leg of his chair, toppling it and walking back across the yard to class. 12. The end of my own middle passage came in midwinter, the perfect time to be a goth. You're in tune with the misery all around you, like that clock that's right twice a day. I was on the way to my father's. The bus doors wouldn't open for the height of snow already in front of them. I had to force them apart with my black leather gloves and step down into a drift, protected from the intense cold by steel-capped black DMs and layerings of black jersey and black denim, by the heat of bird's nest afro hair, the fug of hardly ever washing. I had become an animal perfectly adapted to its environment. I rang my father's doorbell. A young girl answered the door. Perhaps she was 20. Her hair was in very basic twists. She had a sweet teardrop of a face and flawless skin that shone like the peel of an aubergine. She looked fearful, smiled nervously, turned around and called my father's name, but with such a thick accent it was hardly his name at all. She disappeared and was replaced by my father, and after that she didn't come out of his bedroom for the rest of my visit. As we walked through the dilapidated communal hallway, past the curling wallpaper, rusted mailboxes, filthy carpet, he quietly explained to me, as if he were a missionary and a little bashful to reveal the true extent of his charity, that he'd found this girl in King's Cross Station.
She was barefoot. She'd nowhere to go, nowhere at all. You see, she's from Senegal.
Her name is Mercy. You should have rung to say you were coming.
I ate dinner as usual, watched an old movie, The Green Pastures, and when it came time to go, and still nothing more about Mercy had been said by either of us, I saw him look back over his shoulder at his bedroom door, but Mercy did not reappear, and after a while I left. I didn't tell my mother or anyone at school. The only person I felt would understand was Tracy, and I hadn't seen her in months. I'd noticed that other people had this adolescent gift for spiraling out of control, of going off the rails, but whatever catch inside of themselves they managed to release in times of sadness or trauma, I wasn't able to find in myself. Instead, self-consciously, like an athlete deciding on a new training regime, I decided to go off the rails. But no one took me very seriously, least of all my mother, for she considered me a fundamentally reliable teenager. When other local mothers stopped her in the street, as they often did, to ask advice about their wayward sons and daughters, she would listen to them sympathetically but without any concern on her part, sometimes bringing the conversation to a close by putting a hand to my shoulder and saying something like, "Well, we're very lucky we don't have those sorts of problems, not yet." This narrative was so cemented in her mind that any attempt I made to stray from it she simply couldn't see. She was attached to a shadow me, and followed this instead. And wasn't she right? I was not really like my new friends, not especially self-destructive or reckless. I hoarded unnecessary condoms, was terrified of needles, too afraid of blood generally to contemplate cutting myself, always stopped drinking before truly incapacitated, had a very healthy appetite, and when I went clubbing would sneak away from my crew, or conspire to lose them, at around a quarter past midnight so that I could beat my mother, whose rule it was to pick me up at exactly half past the hour every Friday night, outside the stage door of the Camden Palace. I'd get into her car and bitch spectacularly about this arrangement while always, secretly, feeling grateful it existed. The night we rescued Tracy was like that, the Camden Palace night. Normally, my circle went to an indie night there, which I could just about tolerate, but this time we had gone for some reason to a hardcore show, shredded guitars distorting the huge speakers, a raging noise, and at a certain point I realized I wasn't going to make it till midnight, even though I'd battled with my mother for exactly this dispensation. Around 11:30, I said I was heading to the bathroom, and stumbled through that old theatre, once a vaudeville place, found a spot in one of the empty booths on the first floor, and set about getting drunk on the little bottle of cheap vodka I carried around in a pocket of my black trench coat. I knelt on the threadbare velvet where the chairs had been ripped out, and looked down into the mosh pit. I got a sad sort of satisfaction from the thought that I was very likely the only soul in the place at that moment who knew that Chaplin had played here, and Gracie Fields. Not to mention all the long-forgotten dog acts, family acts, lady-hoofers, acrobats, minstrels. I looked down at all those disaffected suburban white kids dressed in black, hurling themselves at each other, and imagined in their place G.H. Eliot, the chocolate-coloured coon, dressed head-to-toe in white, singing off the silvery moon. Behind me I heard the curtain swish. A boy walked into my booth. He was a white boy, very skinny. No older than me, and clearly high on something, with deep-pitted acne and a lot of dyed black hair falling over his cratered forehead. But his eyes were a beautiful blue, and we were of the same ersatz tribe. We wore the same uniform, the black denim, black cotton, black jersey, black leather. I don't think we even spoke to each other. He just came forward and I faced him, already on my knees, and reached up for his fly. We undressed as minimally as possible, lay back on that ashtray of a carpet, and became attached at the groin for a minute or so, while the rest of our bodies remained apart, each swaddled in its layers of black. It was the only time in my life that sex occurred without its shadow, without the shadow of ideas about sex or fantasies regarding it of the kind that can only accumulate over time. On that balcony, all was still exploratory, experimental. And technical, in the sense of figuring out exactly what went where. I'd never seen any pornography. That was still possible then. It seemed wrong for goths to kiss, so we bit gently at each other's necks like little vampires.
Afterwards, he sat up and said in a much posher voice than I'd expected, "But we didn't use anything." Was it his first time too? I told him it didn't matter, in a voice which probably surprised him just as much, and then asked him for a cigarette, which he gave me in the form of a pinch of tobacco, a Rizzler, and a square of cardboard. We agreed to go down to the bar and get a snake bite together, but on the staircase I lost him in a crowd surging upwards, and suddenly, desperate for air and space, I made my way instead to the exit and out into Camden at the witching hour. Everyone was barreling around, half-lit, falling out of the pubs in their torn denim and check or black on black, some sitting on the floor in circles, singing, playing guitars, others being told by a man to see another man further down the road who had the drugs that the first man was meant to have. I felt at once brutally sober, lonely, and wished my mother would appear. I joined a ring of strangers on the ground who looked to be from my tribe and rolled that fag. From where I sat, I could see up the side street to the jazz cafe and was struck by what a different crowd was gathered at its doors, not on their way out but on the way in, and not at all drunk, as these were people who loved dancing, who did not need to be drunk to convince their bodies to move. Nothing they wore was torn or shredded or defaced with Tippex. Everything was flash as flash could be. The women shone and dazzled, and no one sat on the ground. On the contrary, all effort had been made to separate the clientele from the ground. The men's trainers had 2 inches of air built into them, and the women's shoes had double that in heel. I wondered what they were queuing for. Maybe a brown girl with a flower in her hair was going to sing for them. I thought of walking up there and sing for myself, but just then I became aware of a commotion outside the entrance to the Mornington Crescent tube stop. Some sort of problem between a man and a woman. They were yelling at each other, and the man had the woman up against the wall. He was shouting at her and had his hand around her throat. The boys I was sitting with did not move or seem very concerned. They kept playing the guitar or else rolling up their joints. It was 2 girls who took action, a tough-looking bald girl and perhaps her girlfriend. And I stood up with them both, not shouting like them, but following quickly behind. As we got closer, though, the situation became confused. It became less clear whether the victim was being hurt or helped. We saw her legs had gone floppy beneath her, and that the man was in some sense holding her up, and we all slowed down a little in our approach. The bald girl became less aggressive, more solicitous, and in the same moment I realized the woman was not a woman, but a girl, and that I knew her. Tracy. I ran up to her. She recognized me but couldn't speak. She only reached out and smiled sadly. Her nose was bleeding, both nostrils. I smelt something awful and looked down and saw vomit all over her front and in a pool at the floor. The man let go of her and stepped back. I stepped in, held her, and said her name, "Tracy, Tracy, Tracy." But her eyes rolled back in her head, and I felt her full weight in my arms. This being Camden, every passing pisshead and stoner had a theory. Bad E, dehydration, alcohol poisoning, probably done a speedball. You had to keep her standing or lie her down, or give her some water, or move back and give her some air. And I was beginning to panic when, cutting through this noise from across the road, came a much louder voice, one with real authority, calling Tracy's name and mine together. My mother, pulling up in front of the palace as previously agreed, at 12:30 a.m. in her little 2CV. I waved at her, and she lurched forward again and parked beside us. Confronted with such a fierce-looking and capable adult, everyone else dispersed, and my mother did not even pause to ask what seemed to me to be necessary questions. She separated the two of us, laid Tracy out on the back seat, elevated her head with a couple of serious books she had with her at all times, even in the middle of the night, and drove us straight to St. Mary's. I wanted so much to tell Tracy of my balcony adventure, of how, for once, I had been truly reckless. We emerged onto the Edgware Road. She snapped out of it and sat up. But when my mother tried gently to explain what was happening and where we were going, Tracy accused us both of kidnapping her, of trying to control her. We who had always been trying to control her, ever since she was a child, who always thought we knew what was best for her, what was best for everybody. We had even tried to steal her from her own mother, her own father. Her anger grew in proportion to my mother's icy calm, until, when we pulled into the A&E car park, she was leaning right forward in her seat, spitting on the back of our necks in her fury. My mother would not be baited or diverted. She told me to take the left side of my friend as she took the right, and we half-dragged, half-compelled Tracy into the waiting room, where she became, to our surprise, utterly compliant, whispering, "Speedball," to the nurse, and then waiting with a handful of tissues pressed to her nostrils until she was seen. My mother went in with her. About 15 minutes later she came out, I mean my mother did, and said Tracy would be staying overnight, that her stomach would have to be pumped, and that she'd said, Tracy had, a number of sexually explicit things in her delirium to a stressed Indian doctor on his night shift. She was still only 15 years old.
"Something serious happened to that girl," my mother murmured, kissed her teeth, and bent over a desk to sign some papers in loco parentis.
In this context, my own mild drunkenness wasn't worth troubling over. Spotting the vodka bottle in my coat, my mother removed it, without discussion, and dropped it into a hospital bin meant for medical waste. On the way out, I caught a reflection of myself in the long mirror on the wall of a disabled toilet that happened to have, at that moment, its door flung wide open. I saw my drab black uniform and absurd dusted face. Of course, I'd seen it all before, but not under that stark hospital lighting, and now it was no longer the face of a girl. Now a woman stared back. The effect was very different from anything I had seen before by the light of the dim purple bulb in my black-walled room. I was over the threshold. I gave up the gothic life. Part 5. Night and Day. 1. They sat opposite each other. It felt very intimate. If you could put out of mind the millions of people looking on. Earlier they had wandered through his peculiar home together, looking at his treasures, his gaudy art, his terrible gilt furniture, talking of this and that, and at one point he sang for her and performed a few of his signature moves. But there was only one thing we wanted to know, and finally she seemed to be preparing to ask it, and even my mother, who was pottering around the flat and claimed not to be interested, paused and sat down next to me in front of the television and waited to see what would happen. I reached for the remote control and turned it up. "Okay, Michael," she said. "Then let's go to the thing that is most discussed about you, I think, is the fact that the color of your skin is obviously different than when you were younger, and so I think it has caused a great deal of speculation and controversy as to what you have done or are doing." He looked down, began his defense. My mother didn't believe a word of it, and for the next few minutes I couldn't hear a thing either of them said. There was only my mother arguing with the television. "So I'm a slave to the rhythm," he said, and smiled, though he looked bewildered, desperate to change the subject. And Oprah let him change it, and the conversation moved on. My mother walked out of the room. After a while, I got bored myself and switched it off. I was 18. My mother and I never lived together again after that year, and already we were unsure how to relate to each other in our new incarnations. Two adult women occupying, for the moment, the same space. Were we mother and daughter still? Friends? Sisters? Flatmates? We had different schedules, didn't see much of each other, but I worried I'd outstayed my welcome, like a show that goes on too long. Most days I went to the library, tried to revise, while she worked each morning as a volunteer, at a center for troubled youth, and, in the evenings, at a black and Asian women's refuge. I don't say she was not sincere in this work, and good at it too, but it's also the case that both commitments look impressive on your CV if you happen to be standing for election as a local councillor. I'd never seen her so busy. She seemed to be all over the neighbourhood at once, involved in everything, and everybody agreed that divorce suited her. She looked younger than ever. I sometimes had fears that at some point, not many years in the future, we would converge upon the exact same age. I didn't often get down the street in her ward now without someone coming up to thank me for all your mother is doing for us, or ask me to ask her if she had any idea about how to start an after-school club for the newly arrived Somali children, or what local space might be appropriate for a cycling proficiency class. She hadn't been elected to anything, not yet. But round our way, the people had already crowned her. One important aspect of her campaign was the idea to turn the old bike shed on the estate into a community meeting space, which brought her into conflict with Louis and his crew, who used the shed for their own activities. My mother told me later that he sent two young men round to the flat to intimidate her, but she knew their mothers and was not afraid, and they left without winning the argument. I can believe it. I helped her paint the place a vivid yellow and went with her around the local businesses, looking for unwanted stackable chairs. Entry was set at £1 and covered some basic refreshments. Kilburn Books sold relevant literature from a trestle table in the corner. It opened in April. Every Friday at 6 o'clock, speakers appeared, at my mother's invitation, all kinds of eccentric local people, spoken word poets, political activists, drug counsellors, an unaccredited academic who wrote self-published books about suppressed historical conspiracies, a brash Nigerian businessman who lectured us about black aspirations, a quiet Guyanese nurse, evangelical about shea butter. Many Irish speakers were invited, too, as a mark of respect towards that original, fast-fading local population. But my mother could be tin-eared about the struggles of other tribes, and did not hesitate to give lofty introductions. "Wherever we fight for freedom, the fight is the same!" to shifty-looking gangsters who pinned tricolours to the back wall and passed round IRA collection buckets at the end of their speeches. Subjects that seemed to me historically obscure and distant from our situation, the 12 tribes of Israel, the story of Kunta Kinte, anything to do with ancient Egypt, were the most popular, and I was often sent over to the church on these occasions to beg the deacon for extra chairs. But when speakers were concerned with the more prosaic aspects of our everyday lives, local crime, drugs, teenage pregnancy, academic failure, then they could count only on the few old Jamaican ladies who came, whatever the subject, who came really for the tea and biscuits. But there was no way for me to get out of any of it. I had to go to it all. Even the schizophrenic who walked into the room carrying foot-high piles of notes, held together with elastic bands and organized according to some system known only to him, and spoke to us with great passion about the racist fallacy of evolution that dared connect sacred African man to the base and earthly monkey, when in fact he, sacred African man, was descended from pure light, that is, from the angels themselves, whose existence was somehow proved, I forget exactly how, by the pyramids. Sometimes my mother spoke. On those nights the room was packed. Her subject was pride in all its forms. We were to remember that we were beautiful, intelligent, capable, kings and queens, in possession of a history, in possession of a culture, in possession of ourselves. And yet the more she filled the room with this effortful light, the clearer the sense I got of the shape and proportions of the huge shadow that must, after all, hang over us. One day she suggested that I speak. Maybe a young person could reach the young people more easily. I think she was genuinely confused that her own speeches, though popular, had not yet stopped the girls getting pregnant or the boys smoking weed or dropping out of school or going on the rob. She gave me a number of possible topics, none of which I knew anything about, and when I said as much, she got exasperated with me. "The problem with you is you've never known struggle." We settled into a long row. She attacked the soft subjects I'd chosen to study, the inferior colleges I'd applied to, the lack of ambition, as she saw it, that I had inherited from the other side of my family. I walked out, tramped up and down the high road for a bit, smoking fags, before submitting to the inevitable and heading to my father's. Mercy was long gone. There had been no one since. He was living alone once more and seemed to me stricken, sadder than I'd ever known him. His working hours, which still began each morning before dawn, were a new kind of problem for him. He didn't know what to do with his afternoons. A family man by instinct, he was completely lost without one, and I wondered if his other children, his white children, ever came to see him. I didn't ask. I was embarrassed to ask. The thing I feared was no longer my parents' authority over me, but that they might haul out into the open their own intimate fears, their melancholy and regrets. I saw enough of all this in my father already. He'd become one of those people he'd once liked to tell me about, that he met on his route and had always pitied. Old boys in their house slippers watching the afternoon shows until the evening shows began, seeing hardly anyone, doing nothing. Once I came round and Lambert turned up, but after a brief flurry of cheeriness between them, they fell into the dark and paranoid moods of middle-aged men abandoned by their women,